looking today at 2001, both the novel and the film, we want to kind of move between those two. Unfortunately, the tech apparatus doesn't allow that. That move to be very, that flow between the two to be very smooth. I'd like to, just to give you an overview of the terrain I'd like to cover, I went to the classes of three out of four of you in the last 2 days, the sections of three out of four of the PAs, the PAs, and I was really impressed with the number of different interesting perspectives on science fiction that you have in this class. I mean, it's fun to teach science fiction partly because a number of you have been thinking about this many years. Others of you maybe have not and just started with this class. So I thought what I do, because I couldn't obviously drive these things from my mind, is to weave some of the ideas developed by you, both the three PAs that I heard and by you, into the lecture, and even at points say where I disagree, and try to kind of create a larger framework for thinking about 2001. In Jennifer Story's class today, there was discussion of the ending, the enigmatic ending. I'm not going to resolve that for you because Elizabeth comes on stage Tuesday, and she's going to unravel those mysteries for you, right? just to put and it is, I mean, it's a provocative ending. It's supposed to be an ending that startles and serves people because this film, especially, but also the novel, is trying to get you to be active, trying to get you to be critical and interpretive and reflective. That's one of the main points I'd like to kind of demonstrate today. Here is a sort of, just to give you a little preview of where I'd like to go, I'd like, as I have with other texts, to define the historical context out of which this was written. And it is very much of its own period in the later half of the Cold War, and also in terms of its technology. Then I'd like to discuss the sort of what I see as the central theme of 2001, something mentioned quite explicitly and discussed at length in Elizabeth Freudenheim's section, the relationship between tools and humans, and then by implication, technology and humans. I'd also like to get at the way in which Clark and Kubrick try to do a higher kind of science fiction, a science fiction that's more ambitious than the science fiction that went before it, and talk about both the themes of this text, but also the cinematic techniques that are used by Kubrick to try to do big science fiction. The sort of last topic that I want to take up is the one that is really part of popular culture in this film, that is the question of the human and the computer, and especially Hal's rebellion or the crisis on discovery about how humans and Hal are going to interact. And as I said, I've left, you know, the really hard thing will be for Tuesday, but I also think that probably most of you, everyone will be able to catch up and read that. And today we're just going to take a beginning at looking at the difference between the novel and the film, as well as trying to understand the way one works out the logic of the other. Because a number of you will be, I'm sure, choosing that as a topic for the second paper. And in other words, there are going to be several topics that I'll announce on Tuesday, or I'll get up on the web by Tuesday, with the help of our four TAs, several topics that deal with, compare how Kubrick and Clark deal with the same material, the same topic, the same issue. And there are many different kinds of papers that could be written about that. And I'd like to kind of lay the groundwork for thinking about that without trying to answer all the questions. This is one of the most successful science fiction works ever created, 2001. It is successful both as a novel, which has sold millions of copies, and as a film, millions of people have seen the film, even though it's long and ambitious. And it's too long for you? Because there were people that stormed out and said, I don't know what happened, you know, when it first appeared. And they were sick. Rock Hudson, for example, is also been famous for stopping out of the premiere and saying, this is ridiculous. What the hell is this about? And people have been doing that ever since. A lot of people don't like this film. But it's been enormously influential. And I'd like to start by just discussing how it came to be. It started with a short story that Clark had published in 1951 called The Sentinel of Eternity. That story, in other words, appeared in the kind of format that we've looked at before with Gernsback and others' amazing stories. It was published something called 10 Science Fiction, and it recorded the discovery in just 12 pages of a pyramid-shaped thing on the moon, which the narrator feels proves that intelligent life exists elsewhere than Earth. He first thinks it might be a Mayan pyramid or an Egyptian one, I mean, you know, that is produced by a mood society like that, but then he quickly comes to the conclusion that it has to be put there. And this kind of science fiction is highbrow, intellectual, and speculative. I mean, that's Arthur Clarke. But Kubrick, when he decided, if you look at Kubrick's film Oeuvre, what you see is that he goes into different genres. I mean, Lolita is a sort of scandalous, sexy novel. The Eyes Wide Shut is his porn novel. Full Metal Jacket is his war, film. Full Metal Jacket is his war film. And the film that he made before this was what? Before 2001.
Strangelove?
Now I'm confused. I thought it was Dr. Strangelove, but I think that's previous political film. Clockwork Orange came later, definitely later, because it's Anthony Burgess and the British pop scene. I think that's early 70s. 71. This is 68, and Dr. Strangelove is does anybody know the exact date, Dr. Strangelove?
64, 65.
It was a war, but it was about the Cold War also, but it's political satire. And this is his effort to do science fiction in a big way. And what is Kubrick getting from Clarke? Why did he invite Clarke to collaborate? Well, Kubrick believed that if he wanted to get into the sort of full process of producing a film, what you needed to do is be as realistic as possible. That is, and to do that, you had to find the people who knew about it. So when he was doing Eyes Wide Shut, he said, how much money would you need to live in a Park Avenue apartment or Fifth Avenue apartment as a doctor? I mean, he works for details. And so he went to the person who is not only an accomplished science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke, but also a foremost expert on satellite and space exploration. What does Clarke get from Kubrick? Well, he's been doing all these novels. He gets one of the great filmmakers of his time to visualize his story and bring it to a whole group of readers, rather filmgoers, who would never be readers. So each is doing sort of scratching the other's back in a way. And it's a real collaboration. It's a foreword described in a very self-serving foreword that's in the edition with the sign for this class. And Clarke is clearly trying to use Kubrick's fame to make itself more famous. What interests me is that what does this mean, this collaboration in this double text, double narrative, one novel, one film? I think it means that neither the book nor the film is prior to the other, either temporally, creatively, or ontologically. In other words, they start off, the kernel is the short story, they write the film script and the novel at the same time, the first draft of the novel. And then Kubrick does this film. Clarke looks at the rushes, that is the unedited film stock of them, and then he re-edits the novel so it corresponds more precisely to the film. But he does not go back and try to incorporate in the novel the new scenes that Kubrick has added. And Kubrick certainly drops out a bunch of stuff that's in the novel. And one of the questions that I just want to leave suspended is, are Kubrick and Clarke really, do they have a different perspective on what's happening in the action? And that's a question I just like to suspend there. I mean, is one darker or lighter? Is one, we'll return to that perhaps next week. So what are the contexts out of which this novel grew? Well, the first and most obvious one is the Cold War, the context that I mentioned with Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness. But The Left Hand of Darkness comes in 69, and it's at the edge of the Cold War, when the Cold War is really beginning to lose a lot of its sort of structure of beliefs. And it imagines the ecumen, the alliance, which is outside of the Cold War, the narrative is outside of the Cold War, it's beyond the Cold War, it's left the Cold War behind. Whereas Clarke's 2001 also imagines a kind of end of the Cold War, but you see all the signs of Cold War culture in this text. For one thing, you know, just to think about the Cold War for a moment, what does it mean? It's about rivalry and deadly weaponry. It's about the fact that nuclear arms are so deadly that they make actual war impossible. You have a doctrine of mutual assured destruction, so if the Soviets launched missiles, we would launch on warning. We would launch all our missiles. So even an accident could produce a devastating nuclear war. In the Dawn of Man sequence, we see a kind of parody of the Cold War struggle when we have the two sets of man apes fighting over the water hole. And I think it's almost a silly satire. I mean, they demonstrate and jump up and down and make sounds to kind of get claims to the water hole. But they look the same. What defines them? They're on two different sides of the water hole. What defines the Arabs and Israel, you know, the Palestinians and the Israelis? When you're outside of a conflict and look at it, what you see is a mirror image, specularity. Left-hand side is behaving just like the right-hand side. They think they're completely unique and different, but in fact, they're locked in a struggle that makes them look and behave the same. Each blames the other for everything and so on. And the absurdity of that Cold War system lies in the background of this text. It's an effort to move beyond that text. But how does it try to move beyond the Cold War story? Well, an early title for this was How the Solar System Was Won. And that's a parody of how the what was won. Right, the West. And so the West is the site of the frontier, of the wild, of the untamed, of that which we've not yet explored. And it makes men of you to go West, right? And so it's a site for a kind of struggle and faith during the Cold War, and especially starting with the Sputnik in 58 and continuing through the 60s. The space was sold as the next frontier. I mean, you didn't take Star Trek come up with that notion of a final frontier or next frontier. It was actually embedded in John Kennedy's campaign for presidency when he talked about the new frontier. And then when he became elected, about a year after he was president, he gave a famous speech in which he set the goal, and most of you I'm sure have heard about this, of going to the moon. And these are the words that he used. And what I'd like you to notice is the way in which going to the moon doesn't end rivalry with the Soviet Union. It is about rivalry with the Soviet Union. But it is moving beyond, it's sublimating pure war for something different, a space race. Let's not have war, even Cold War. Let's do something more enlightened for mankind. Let's race to the moon. So he says in this speech, if we're going to win the battle that is going on around the world between freedom and tyranny, that is the U.S. and the S.U., if we are to win the battle for men's minds, the dramatic achievements in space, which occurred in recent weeks, and this was just after a successful launch, should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, that was the day, not 58, the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take, and so on. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share. I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. So you see how the beginning of the speech is about a Cold War rivalry, but the end modulates into a more idealistic project. This is something that's been done for all humankind. Now, there are two other things that are important about this setting of the space race and the Cold War. The first is that it requires big science, and he refers to it being really expensive to do that. And the Apollo project that was funded at this time was spending about $10 million a day, the whole cost of doing 2001, by the time Kubrick and Clark were working on their project. But that kind of big science was really started in World War II, and especially with the Manhattan Project that many of you know about, building the atomic bomb. And what's important about this setting is that it requires coordinating the activities of literally thousands of scientists, engineers, military personnel, strategic planners. And to organize that many people, you have to develop a bureaucracy. And what you see in 2001 are a lot of scenes, especially in the second segment, of bureaucratic behavior. People, sort of colorless bureaucrats, getting together in committee meetings and giving speeches about how to spin this, how to keep that secret. And some of Kubrick's best satire is directed at this kind of big science, big bureaucratic science. Finally, space is popular. You know, according to some counts on the World Wide Web, the NASA site gets the most hits of any website. They have fantastic pictures, of course, and they're free. But also, space is incredibly popular. And our vice chancellor for research, Franz Cordova, who is the new appointed chancellor at Riverside, was a chief scientist at NASA, and I've heard her speak about what interests people at NASA. And guess what interests people at NASA? Big rockets? Really complex science? No. Extraterrestrial life. That's what people want out of space. That's the great popular yearning, the real desire for space. The idea that humans are not alone on this planet, and that when our sun burns out, it won't be all over. And the only way it won't be all over is if we find some other extraterrestrial life, or we become extraterrestrial life. And that means we need space travel. So how does this move, how does this project, 2001, move beyond the Cold War? First of all, by taking a really long view of human life. Let's just talk. The way you do that is you take a really long view of life. A long view of human history. You orient us towards a higher evolutionary stage. And the idea is that if we could see Earth from a third position of extraterrestrial, of the extraterrestrial, neither the Soviet Union nor the U.S., of the free world or the communist world, if we could see that from that, the world or in history from a third position, perhaps we could see the unity of the Earth and its life and overcome Cold War rivalry. Now, there's a second really crucial context that I'll suggest quickly for this 2001, and that's the computer and computerization. This is important to Asimov, but here we meet the computer at a different stage in its development. And this text introduces Hal, the figure who won an Oscar, and who's probably the most popular, the most well-known computer in the history of film. And one of the important contexts here is the development of the computer, because the computer started as a military project, but by the 60s it has become part of the way corporations and large institutions operated. And IBM computers especially became ubiquitous in the mid-60s, although they weren't obviously personal computers at that time. They weren't everyday objects. Fans of 2001 quickly noticed something about the lettering of HAL. You know what it is?
Oh, sequence from IBM.
Yeah, you just advance one letter, H to I, A to B, and so on. You could morph HAL into IBM. And what I find amusing about this, if you look at the record, there's no evidence that HAL is a secret kind of way of getting IBM into the picture and suggesting that IBM is murderous. But it's the same kind of paranoid reading that the film requires is being applied in sort of popular culture. But something else is important about the computer, and that is that computers have become technically crucial to space exploration. And in ways that Clark very carefully describes in this, and accurately describes in this novel, where he shows how, in order to time the firing of jets to navigate in space, you have to have the help of an onboard computer. And it was really the development of software and silicon chips that allowed the U.S. to pass the Russians and land on the moon, something the Russians tried to do but never could do, even though their rockets were better than ours. Now, what's interesting about the relationship to the computer is the contrast with Asimov. If you remember in iRobot, Asimov had very carefully explored the rivalry and exchange between humans and computers. And recall that the very last story, The Inevitable Conflict, robots and computer brains win out over humans, and Dr. Susan Calvin is not worried about it. She says, look, computers are fundamentally decent, and they can run our history better than we can. And this represents a triumph for what I like to call, and it's a familiar term in cultural theory, instrumental rationality. What that means is, to unpack that term, is that there's a reason or rationale behind things. So the fear that lies behind this is that, you know, in iRobot, instrumental rationality is welcomed, it's fine. But in a host of other science fiction films, the idea that the world is becoming more and more rational, that everything is being organized by a central purpose, and that systems are being developed, and people are being organized, and technologies are being developed to organize us in an instrumental fashion so we can achieve one thing, this is a terrifying prospect in countless science fiction films. And the computer often lies at the center of this idea in science fiction of instrumental rationality. So in Colossus, the Forman Project, the computers take over the Cold War system. In A Separate Wise, which I'll come back to in a moment, technology is used to rationalize the world. Terminator and The Matrix are both premised upon a takeover by a computer-based machine machines that turn on their makers in a kind of replay of the Frankenstein syndrome. In these films, the humans have conferred so much technological power upon intelligent machines that the machines throw off their subordinate position and in very different ways assume mastery over the masters. And this is a very familiar idea, right? But what's interesting about 2001 is that it lies halfway between Asimov's optimism about computers and rationalization and the pessimism of something like the Stepford Wives. Think about the Stepford Wives for a moment. Women are getting uppity, they're demanding equality, they're not doing their domestic chores. So what do? You remake them into dutiful wives, use systems of high-tech cloning, and now you've rationalized them by turning them into an instrument of male gratification and pleasure. Most of you have credit cards. When they first developed credit cards, banks found that it was really difficult to figure out who was creditworthy and who wasn't. And so as early as the 60s, they started using computers, companies like TRW, you've probably heard of, to keep a record of every credit card transaction registered in the computer systems of various banks. So now, I mean, you come along the very late stage of this system, but this is an everyday example of instrumental rationality, that the computer is used to track human behavior so it can decide whether you are creditworthy. And one of the things you'll find is if you get a bad credit rating, it's very hard to get out of that system. You can't just walk away from it. It's everywhere. It's around you. And its reason, its rationale of the credit system is profit, right? Profits for the banks, for the credit card companies. In 2001, there's a kind of ambivalence about technology and computer use of the computer. They have some of the awe and love of technology and the beauty of technology evident in Asimov, and you see that we'll see that in a number of ways. But they also encourage, the whole film does, it encourages a kind of reflection about what's wrong with technology. You know, what is problematic about the power we're giving technology? Another side to this you can see in 2001 is the meaning of space travel. You know, in science fiction we discuss the way in which space travel is a kind of metaphor for freedom and liberation. You're getting away from Earth, you're moving fast, there's something transforming about doing that. But here, if you think about the scenes in 2001, things are oddly confining. You know, there isn't, until the very end of the film, and even there it's very problematic, there isn't a sense of exhilarating a kind of rush from space travel. So what is the central kind of way into 2001? What is the central theme of 2001? And, of course, you can answer that question more than one way, but I'd like to look at it in these terms, in terms of the question of how humans relate to their tools. And I'd like to read a quote from Kubrick that he gave to a magazine after 2001 came out, in which he talks about the importance of tools. I think it resonates in an interesting way. It's simply an observable fact that all of man's technology grew out of the discovery of the tool weapon. There's no doubt that there is a deep emotional relationship between man and his machine weapons, which are his children. The machines begin to assert itself in a very profound way, even attracting affection and obsession. This is very prescient, you know, I mean, it's an idea that is much more part of our life in the 21st century than it was in the 60s. But understanding this intimate emotional connection between humans and their babies, you know, the kind of techno objects they produce. And there's a lot of technophilia in this film, not phobia, but philia, love of technology. And it's in those beautiful spaceships that is bright white against the black sky, drifting through space effortlessly. The first tools, of course, are a very simple form of technology. And what Clark and Kubrick want to do, I think, is to explore along the longest possible trajectory this relationship. They do so by expanding the reach of the narrative back in human history, but also forward in human history, temporally, but also spatially. On Earth, in Africa, when men, apes live in little valleys, they hardly ever leave to space and the whole solar system and beyond. And so it seems to me that theme is what links the four sections of the four discrete different settings, temporal segments of novel and film. In the Dawn of Man sequence, we have the monolith appearing among the man-apes and teaching the man-apes to use tools. And here, tools have a fairly innocent use, at least at first, or don't, or do they? They seem to be the key to human survival, especially in Clark's narrative, but it also comes as a kind of mastery. And we see, after all, what looks like the first murder. And murder is a way to enforce the kind of mastery. But what is the monolith? Here, and there was a very good discussion of this in Elizabeth Gordenheim's section, you know, it seems to be a device for diagnostic, for teaching, a catalyst to work a change in the man apes while remaining unchanged itself. That's what the definition of a catalyst is. It works the chemical reaction, but itself is not in the chemical reaction, doesn't change itself. But it's also a kind of super two-way medium for transmitting information. It's cold and luminous in the novel. It's luminous instead of sort of a grand black. So it's like a TV screen almost. And it also has an advanced intelligence in back of it. So that's part of its mystery and wonder, that some higher intelligence is using that monolith to communicate with the men apes. In the second segment, the monolith is something quite different. It's the same monolith, but it functions differently. Humans have used really advanced technology to build new tools, ships to explore the moon and excavate the monolith. But here it functions as a signaling device. And of course that signal, that powerful sound they hear and that they track through the solar system and beyond, produces a set of questions. Who is signaling whom? You know, or what extraterrestrial intelligence has set up this system as a signaling device? And so the second appearance of the monolith, it signifies something very clearly, that intelligent life exists beyond Earth. Now the paranoid interpretation that's given it by the moon mission group, the U.S. Group, is that we have to assume it's intelligent life and that it may be malevolent, so it must be kept a secret. You know, the center of the novel is the journey of discovery to Jupiter and then Saturn in the book and just to Jupiter in the film. And the spaceship for discovery is not just an advanced tool, you know, where you have pods for navigating and communications links across the solar system and a high-tech brain named Hal. It also is a kind of utterly controllable environment for space travel that's controlled by Hal and mission control. In other words, it's a triumph of instrumental rationality. And what is the reason or rationale for all this elaborate instrumentation? It's a journey to the monolith. It becomes the object of investigation that justifies the mission. And this secrecy turns out to be quite poisonous on the mission. And so I think one of the things you have to think about is the secrecy justified? Is it keeping it secret from Frank Poole and Dave Bowman justified? And so we want to consider the ethical implications of that when we come back to the issue of the computer and humans. And finally, you have a different kind of role for the monolith in the ride through the Stargate. It is instead of the extraterrestrials behind the monolith that they drop their bodies and they become spaceships. In other words, you could say that the highest form of life, there's no opposition between tools and humans at all. I mean, maybe this is a way of thinking this. Humans actually become tools. They become purer for overcoming the opposition from between the human and the tool. You don't have to have a politics around how humans and computers interact with one another as humans and tools if they become one. But as I said, the ending is deliberately provocative and questionable. The film was advertised as the ultimate trip, and the last trip here is that ultimate trip. So what do these four sections have in common? Well, you have human tools and technology at different stages of development, although the pod is the last thing left in the last segment, and they are opposed to the monolith. And in all four settings, the monolith is an enigma. It's blank in some crucial way, whether it's clear or black. And as a precisely engineered slab, it's clearly not part of nature, but the result of intelligent design. So what is the novum? What is the new thing of 2001? What would you say is the kernel idea that starts off this narrative? What would you say? We've asked that about every science fiction narrative we've seen. What is the idea, the germinating idea of 2001? What do you think? How would you put it?
Yeah.
Transformation. Well, see, that's one word, and there are a lot of transformations. Might be a motif, but I'm thinking about Philip Dick and Ursula Le Guin's idea that you have a sort of key idea that changes, allows you to look at everything differently. Let, you know, changes reality so we can look at it differently. Yeah.
That we were not meant to keep going, that we were meant to be extinct and something stopped us from being extinct?
Yeah, I mean, what stopped us?
No.
Yeah. I mean, this is a kind of outrageous idea, right? That the monolith has appeared, we might well have gone extinct. But the monolith appeared back in the dim early, actually before they were human, and carried on this exchange with these men apes and facilitated our becoming human. So what if, I would put it this way, what if the human developed out of men apes not because of spontaneous evolutionary development, but because a more advanced form of intelligent life from another place in the universe placed a monolith on our planet from which we learned to use tools. And from that, everything else follows. With the tools, we can survive and master our environment instead of becoming extinct, as Kim mentioned. We get fire, language, agriculture, writing, advanced cultures, towns, cities. All of that could happen because of this crucial event. And this is, I think, the speculation out of which the fiction is built. Usually, most science fiction, we have human history, and then we go someplace to find extraterrestrials, or they come down and find us. But the idea that our very existence depends upon some prior encounter, which we've completely forgotten, is a sort of germinating idea here. And this is why I want to disagree with people that I heard say in two different sections that the monolith is a symbol of evolution. I think to say that is to take away the extraterrestrial's power over us. I don't think that's compatible with the Clark-Kubrick idea. Because it doesn't replace, it doesn't simply symbolize spontaneous undirected evolution. It replaces it. It directs it. It has agency in our own early history. In other words, it also makes us the effects of intelligent design. But we weren't designed by God, but by extraterrestrials. And if you say that they're just symbols, like a literary or film way, or they're just symbols of evolution, what you're doing is pulling the fiction back into science, into evolution, into what we know, into what's familiar. You're resisting the kind of far-out idea that's at the core of this fiction. Now, you know, Clark and Kubrick were interested in creating a more advanced form of science fiction, and they did so by changing the kind of science and the kind of fiction that we would find in science fiction. And first of all, they increase the quantity of hard science in the fiction. And this is done by, you know, this is part of the realist claim of this science fiction. Now, you can go read fantasy to help yourself sleep at night, but here you're going to find out what space exploration is really about. And this is why I think Kubrick wanted to collaborate with Clark. It's also why Kubrick hired hundreds of consultants, people like Carl Sagan, to consult on the film, because he wanted the most realistic possible prediction about how space travel would work. And he, of course, uses real satellite images of the moon and the Earth and space. And an early version of the film actually started off with a talking head interview with scientists about the possibility of intelligent life on other planets. Can you believe that? I mean, instead of starting off with Thus Spake Zarathustra, you'd have people sitting around a conference table talking about, yeah, there could be intelligent life out there. Given the numbers, you know, we've got billions of stars, you know, probably billions of planets. And some of those can have life. You know the whole story, right? And he dropped that, thankfully, but I actually like to see it. I think it's on some of the, I think it's available. So this is the way he tries, you know, Kubrick and Clark try to make it realistic. Clark was a real authority on space, as I mentioned. He is the inventor of the communication satellite. And, you know, his anthropology, which is outdated, was pretty good for the time, although there's some errors in there. Kubrick insists, in fact, this is not the usual kind of science fiction. And this is the quote that I have up there.
Is that right?
No, I don't have this quote up there. He says, I don't regard 2001 simply as science fiction. Science fiction is a legitimate field, of course, but there has been bad execution of the visual effect and too much emphasis upon monsters. I mean, this is what he hates about science fiction. He looked at all the science fiction he could find and, you know, everything Clark recommended, and he doesn't like the visual effects. He hates the monsters. He says science 2001 is not fantasy, though a portion of it is speculative. And neither the book nor the film gives us a description or a viewing, a sighting of the extraterrestrial. And he went along with Carl Sagan on this. If extraterrestrials exist, they are so weird, we can't imagine them. And it's part of the integrity of the film that you don't get octopuses with big eyes and so on. Okay, so we get hard science, but we also get the fiction in science fiction used for more ambitious, more thought-provoking purposes. And as Clark points out, the higher purpose is that our sheer fiction probes the mysteries of the cosmos. It investigates the possibilities of extraterrestrial life, and it reinterprets human history, the whole span of human history. It turns to those possibilities. And Clark actually describes Kubrick's idea in a way that's very vivid. He says he wanted to make a movie about man's relation to the universe, something which had never been attempted, much less achieved, in the history of motion pictures. Stanley was determined to create a work of art which would arouse, and here's the definition of the sublime, the emotions of wonder, awe, even if appropriate, terror. Wonder, awe, and terror. I mean, he's going for this very high kind of aesthetic experience. And Kubrick, you know, in comments, which I won't read, said things like, well, we have to figure out how to move on to a higher stage of humanity. We really are just halfway between man and apes and what we could become. And 2001 imagines something like that. He even talks about it as, in terms of God. On the deepest psychological level, the film's plot symbolizes the search for God, and it finally postulates what is little less than a scientific definition of God. So, I don't know if that'll be kind of useful or something that Elizabeth's lecture will deal with. That is, there's a God involved in the film, right, at the end. But one of the things that interests me most is the way he changed film to realize this vision. I mean, that's part of what's really impressive about this. So to pull this sublime kind of project off, Kubrick needs to develop a new visual language for science fiction film, one that does not absorb the spectator, but instead gives the spectator a reflective, speculative relationship to the action, a kind of aesthetic relationship to the flow of images. And I'm trying to suggest how this is done here. First of all, there are no stars hired for this film. He doesn't want fans of whoever, you know, of who would be the person at the time, I don't know, you know, Kurt Douglas or somebody to come to this movie just to see their stars. There's really no-name actors. There are no heroes to identify with. And there are no creepy aliens or monsters which make you go, eek, and yikes, or be startled. He doesn't want, you know, people in costumes walking around fifthly. Also, you know how a lot of science fiction films have moments of high-tech explanation, where you get the wondrous thing explained by some expert. Well, there's some of that in Clark's book, of course, but you notice how Kubrick has cut that down to a very minimum. So you can follow the action, although some people can't, and really make you think about what's happening. You don't get an explanation how the video phone works, so on. You just see it used. Also, there's very little conventional soundtrack. Now, you know how a conventional soundtrack works. It gives you sound that convince you that the characters you see on the film or the action you see on the film is happening in a real space that enfolds you. So you don't just see the image. You hear the image's effect in its fictional world. And also, conventional soundtracks often give you background music which guide your feelings. You know, oh, here's a scary moment. I mean, there's several ways to do that. Or here's a kind of heartwarming moment, a swell of violins, or whatever. He leaves you, there's a little bit of soundtrack in this film, but there's a lot of silence and there's a lot of classical music. And you have, what this does is it gives you, it doesn't enfold you, it doesn't make you feel warm and snuggly in the narrative, it moves along in your seat by the images. Sound working together. There's also very little dialogue, so you can't feel like you're in a play where you go from one scene to the next and you get cues from the characters about what's happening. There's only 62 minutes out of 2.5 hours where there's any kind of speech. And when you get dialogue, what do you get? Pretty yucky, you know, it's cold and stiff, and it's alien. And I think he doesn't want to engage you with the dialogue. The only interesting dialogue comes from a machine. So he's removed all these things. He's stripped these away from his practice of film in this film. He does other conventional things in other films, but here he strips them away. What does he put in its place? What do we get instead? Well, we get scene, settings, images. We get, you know, space and high-tech spaceships. And what this leads to is a kind of visual poetry that invites reflection. So I have his comment on visuality. Because when people first saw the film, many were disappointed. And in order to respond, he points them to the importance of visuality. He says, I don't like to talk about 2001 much. Because this is essentially a nonverbal experience. It attempts to communicate more to the subconscious and to the feelings than it does to the intellect. I think clearly that this is a basic problem with people who are not paying attention with their eyes. They're listening, and they don't get much from listening to this film. Those who won't believe their eyes won't be able to appreciate this film. So we want you to really be pulled in to the visual power of this film. In order to do that, he didn't use 35mm film, the conventional one, but 70mm film. So there's twice as much visual information on every part of the film, each frame. And he presented it in Cinerama, which was a sort of large curved screen. He also, if you see pictures of him on the set, he's always looking through the camera. So he's particularly careful in the posing shot, but he also is heavily involved in editing, too. We also get a certain kind of design. It's a modern minimalist design, very important. And I have just this image over here that you remember from the lobby of the Hilton on the space station. The 20th century is associated modern minimalism with a sort of a spare, stark look and not too much clutter. And I think it rhymes with that kind of instrumental reason or rationality, that you just have what's functional. And according to the modernist credo, form follows function, and that's beautiful. And in some sense, he's trying to create these kinds of environments as a visual experience that's vivid and stark. There's very little clutter, very little texture and complexity. As I mentioned, the soundtrack has a combination of silence, lots of silence, which is kind of a scandal in the film of the day, and classical music. Which makes you make the connection. You know, why here are we hearing the power of the Spexarathustra, and why there are we getting the Danube Waltz? And it also slows down the tempo to get you to look. It doesn't move quick cuts. It's not MTV or MTV-style film. Also, he put an enormous amount of money into special effects. And the special effects budget for this film was $6.5 million out of $10.5 million. Completely unheard of at the time. Although film like Metropolis have a relatively high ratio too, but nothing like that. And special effects are interesting because within the realist aesthetic that dominates Hollywood cinema, the purpose of special effects is to make you believe this world is real. But what if the world you're representing is different, new, sci-fi, high-tech? Well, you've got to use techniques to make that sci-fi world seem realistic. So the codes of Hollywood cinema that demand a kind of plausibility and realism coupled to a science fiction project require special effects, and that's why you have huge special effects budgets. And they built those spaceship models and photographed them with blue screens. The Discovery ship, you know, where the crew jogs in that circular ship, that existed in England, and, you know, Kubrick sat outside of this. He's a control freak. The film is about control. He sat outside of that building sign module of Discovery. It's actually part of the Discovery ship. And he's in a little control booth, and he took one of the characters' roles. Who would that be? Who would you imagine Kubrick would play? What? Right. Hal. So later they dubbed a different voice, and that voice won an Academy Award for Hal. But he was Hal at the beginning. He was the master of instrumental reason, the logic behind the film, talking and arguing with the poor little actors locked into their spaceship. So in other words, the real science fiction shifts to a new place, and special effects have to be drawn after it. Another visual technique, a technique that privileges the visual, is the breaking the film into segments, like Dawn of Man, Mission to Jupiter, to the Moon, Jupiter Mission, panels that shift time. So the result is a kind of amazing lyrical directness, direct address to the spectator, so as to invite reflection. And that's why a lot of people don't like the film. I mean, it's not their cup of tea, you know, it's not what they like, but it's also why it's been enormously influential, because it's challenged the spectator. Now, I'd like to end this segment of the lecture by showing a clip of the most famous cut in history film. The historical tricks of this, of course, is to show that first move, that conceptual breakthrough, and with that link to Thus Spake Zarathustra, the Richard Strauss music, enormous power accumulated from that. Yeah?
Is it? Yeah, it's supposed to be.
You know, he got it. He theoretically could be, because, you know, we saw the leopard, you know, attack human being in that kind of space. But I don't know if it's recognizable as a human bone.
They're saying the technology is good. He's throwing up a bone and enjoy it. If it's the other tribe,
and then this kind of technology is also in some ways celebrated. I mean, it, and also going into the sky, I mean, it's daytime. There's also a contrast, as well as a likening. And part of the power of a simile, I think it's a visual simile. It's practically saying this bone is like that spaceship. And it's the idea of the tool that's linking it, but also there's this huge leap in time, which does seem exuberant and easy. It's as though instead of taking thousands of years of evolution and scientific development. Yeah?
I think it's also interesting that the moon watcher, that's what he's called in the book, that they're trying to kind of say it's his ancestors, people have to remember.
Cool. That's a nice idea, yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought of that kind of connection. And but you notice how also you have to make the connection. I mean, that's the crucial thing, the point I'm making about the visual style that Kubrick developed here, is that, and this isn't a difficult connection to make in the kind of at its first level, but it's inviting you to ponder this. Like, wow, that's kind of an interesting connection. And think of all the things that had to happen to get from bone to spaceship. And maybe the spaceship is a kind of weapon of seeking mastery and control, and has a kind of residue of that violence that was part of the bone. And it's also techno-fetishism. I mean, this is. You know, we have these beautiful white images on a black background juxtaposed to what? The most glorious things in nature. Stars and moon, the earth from a distance. And then you get this sort of gracious music. So that movement is not something that requires effort in this space. It just floats. Just the way, you know, Moonwalker's exuberant, throwing his new toy, weapon, instrument, tool up into the air, has a kind of grace and beauty too, and ease. So there's I think this cut is justly famous, but it's also, you know, open to interpretation. It's not something that ran down your throat. And one of the problems with Clark is that he's always interpreting and chatting and trying to explain things. He's a teacher. And I think that Kubrick uses Clark's story and is much more reticent about trying to explain everything, instead of showing you a kind of visual feel for you to think about and interpret. So I'd like to consider in this part of the lecture this relationship between the machine, like this one, and the human. And sort of start off with the notion that we had in Asimov, that the development of machine intelligence and very advanced machines puts humans in a dilemma. You know, there's a kind of problem for us with really powerful, good, smart machines, because certain tasks and environments like space travel through deep space, make humans dependent upon the computer and machine and technology. This is an example of a kind of instrumental rationality. You know, we're embedded in an environment that has a system that, and that here, they have a control room upstairs, and they're supposed to serve us. But, of course, at times we feel like we've been served and mis-served, and we're structured in a very flexible environment. And so this is the problem. As machines get more powerful, they get smarter. How is the machine still a tool? You know, a tool implies you can go over, pick it up, and manipulate it. But these very high-tech environments embed you in them. And so you feel placed by this technology. And, of course, this is part of what... So, you know, Bill Gates says, everything's a tool, it's just a tool, buy my tool, and he's trying to comfort you, you know, there'll be no problem, you can just do this stuff. He doesn't, you know, worry about blue screens, you know, you might be about the blue screens, you use Windows too much, as I do. And so if, for example, tools morph into something much more ambitious, form of technology, is it something that we have control of? And Clark and Kubrick worked this question in an interesting way in 2001. You remember that Hal is introduced as the sixth member of the crew, and I'd like to look at the way he's talked about, and I've been asked to give chapters as well as pages. So I'd like to look at the way how the most interesting high-tech device in 2001 is introduced. This is on page 116. It's the chapter called How, number 16. And I have the other book here. Some of you are using this book that I taught from a year ago. And I think you'll find this on page 92 of that other text. And just to look at how is introduced, you remember this is a kind of TV special on the Discovery mission. The sixth member of the crew cared for none of these things, that is, fame and riches, for he was not human. It was the highly advanced HAL 9000 computer, the brain and nervous system of the ship. So that kind of functionality, being the brain and nervous system, of course, makes HAL incredibly important. And it's a kind of embedded personification. The ship is a body, it has a brain the way human beings do, and HAL, for a heuristically programmed algorithmic computer, no less, was a masterwork of third computer breakthrough. And then, you know, Clark gives us a quick history of the development of computers. You go to the next page, the next paragraph, whatever way it worked, the final result was a machine intelligence that could reproduce. Some philosophers still prefer to use the word mimic, and of course it's very fraught. Is this real human intelligence, or is it just mining human intelligence? It could reproduce most of the activities of the human brain with far greater speed and reliability, the reasons that computers have always had an edge over humans. It was extremely expensive, and only a few units of the HAL 9000 series had yet been built. But the old jest that it would always be easier to make organic brains by unskilled labor was beginning to sound a little hollow. So this is the kind of goofy sex that you get in science fiction, you know, kind of sly reference to sex as a means to produce brains. It's slipped in here. But you know, it's just barely mentioned because sex is all sublimated here. It's all in the space of the size of the spaceship and things like that, and things they do to one another, or so it seems to me. And then if you go on to the next page, you see something very important about the way HAL, a little point is added about HAL, and his autonomy. That is, like all computers, he works automatically. And he's able, even if the crew was to die or become incapacitated, run the ship. The time might even come, this is the third paragraph from the end of the chapter, might even come when HAL would take command of the ship. In an emergency, if no one answered his signal, he would attempt to wake the sleeping members of the crew by electronic and chemical stimulation. In other words, he's linked into the body of the crew. If they did not respond, he would radio Earth for further orders. And then, if there was no reply from Earth, he would take whatever measures he deemed necessary to safeguard the ship and to continue the mission, whose real purpose, and I love the way this is dropped into a clause at the end of a paragraph. You might miss it on a quick reading because it's crucial for the suspense of the story, whose real purpose he alone knew and which his human colleagues could never have guessed. And here the smart reader will start thinking, what is the real mission? You've been told that you don't know. Poole and Bowman have often humorously referred to themselves as caretakers or janitors aboard a ship that could really run itself. They would have been astonished and more than a little indignant to discover on a ship Discovery, how much truth that jest contained. That they were actually, even though they were human, subordinate in their privileges to the computer. So who's the tool? I mean, HAL is supposed to be a lineal descendant of the first tool that the monolith sent down to Earth, or helped to kind of catalyze the development of among humans. But here, it might be that the humans are more tools of mission control and less tools and more tools than HAL is. And this is the way instrumental rationality works. Everything comes into the larger rationality, which is the mission. As if to, now, you know, there's a very uncomfortable dimension to HAL. In other words, it's just suggested here that he has total control of the ship and that he knows what the mission's really about. And so he's kind of master on the ship in certain ways. However, as if to shield humans from this fact, Poole and Bowman, you know, from grasping the functional and autonomy and functional superiority of HAL is made humane. HAL made the humane, you know, the most humane character in the novel. HAL has a human voice and a sweet manner. He's very polite. and he's relatively talkative, because these guys are really wooden. You know, they don't say anything they don't need to say, right? They've never tried to get free baked sticks for themselves at a bar by their charming talk. And, you know, Hal has his basic human impulses. He's proud of his work, as the interviewer points out. He has an ego, you know, that is a subject, and it defends itself against accusations and threats to be cut off. So he seems to have many of the qualities of a human being. By contrast to Hal, the humans are robotic in their rigorous self-discipline. They've decided to go on this trip, and they follow the regime down to the last minute. They follow the commands of the protocols they've been given. And so they seem less human than Hal. Their voices and faces lack expression. They don't seem to show any real kind of kinship and friendliness to one another. In a world shaped by the logic of instrumental reason, the robot has become humane, while the human has become robotic. So there's a kind of ironic chiasmus. And it seems to me, I mean, that's what Kubrick especially is critiquing, because art gives you a kind of warmer feeling, I think, for the crew members, and glorifies the mission more than Kubrick.